there. Thanks for coming. Take a seat.
It's time to retire to the drawing room.
Have you ever wondered what we look like from space? A new film, A Beautiful Planet, captures the view of Earth from the International Space Station, orbiting 400 kilometres above the planet. That's a lot of distance. My drawing room guest is the film's space consultant, former NASA astronaut Marsha Ivins. Marsha, welcome.
Thank you.
This film is all about what Earth looks like from space, the incredible view from the International Space Station. What struck you the most about what we look like from that far away?
It sounds far away, 400 kilometres, but it really isn't that far. Consider the moon is 400,000 kilometres away. And that's how far away from the Earth you have to be to see it as an entire globe, as an entire ball. So what we see from the space station is about a third or a quarter of the Earth. What you see, as the movie says, blues and whites, gossamer clouds kind of thing. You see the black of space in the background. You see the very sharply defined blue line that is the edge, the curvature of the Earth. You see countries of different colors, very red Australia, less red Africa. You see muted greens and an incredible amount of blue in the ocean.
So it's a contrast game, isn't it, in terms of color?
Well, you know, somebody once likened the Earth from space as a marble. You know, one of those marbles that has all of the swirling colors in it. And it's a little bit like that from far away.
What was your favorite view from the space station? Is there a spot or a country that you can isolate or appreciate?
You know, on my first flight, and I had the opportunity to fly on the space shuttle for five times, and we were at the same orbital altitude at 400 kilometers. And what it looks like, if you can imagine holding a very large ball in your hand, like a globe at arm's length, and then looking across the top of it, that's sort of the way you see the Earth. It's not like looking straight down and recognizing things. And so on my first flight for 11 days, I didn't recognize a single landmass at all. I recognized it was water or it was land, but not exactly where I was. The thing that fascinated me, though, on all of the flights was watching the sunrises and the sunsets, which happen 16 times a day because we go around the Earth once every 90 minutes.
That's really jamming it in, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
You mentioned that you could tell the difference when you first got up there, if I can describe it that way, between the water and the Earth. Did you have to train yourself on being able to identify different places because you couldn't at the beginning? How did you do that?
I had to change my perspective in the way you look at things. I'd seen pictures from space. Of course, I'd seen hundreds and thousands of pictures from space. But as you are moving across the planet, we have a laptop computer with a map application on it, and it tells you where your orbit is crossing any time. So you can sound intelligent even if you, at the moment,
don't actually
feel intelligent. And so you would look at the map and see where you are, and then you can sort of suss out borders and of the edges of the landmass and maybe large rivers. At night, it's a different story. As you can see in the movie, the continents are outlined and they look very much like they do on a map.
And it looks like the way you see it when you're a child for the first time.
Yeah.
I want to talk about your personal experience. How did you go about becoming an astronaut? I think in the 70s?
I wanted to be an astronaut from the very first time I saw an astronaut, which was the very first time there was an astronaut, back in the 60s. And like most children of the 60s, well, many children of the 60s, particularly the ones that became astronauts, we were captivated by watching people get in rockets and go to space on our little black and white TVs. You know, they would bring it into school and stop your class. And you got to stay up late at home and watch people walking on the moon. And I decided then at age 10 and forevermore that I wanted to work with the space program. Well, that wasn't really a career goal or a path or an option for a child of the 60s. And in the 70s, it wasn't really a career option anyway. But I went to university to get an engineering degree because that's what astronauts were when they weren't fighter pilots and men. They were engineers. So I became an engineer. It turns out I could have studied any science, technology, math, physics, you know, any of those fields. And then I actually sent a letter to NASA saying, okay, I'm ready for a job. And NASA hired me 9 months later as an engineer. When they started sending out applications for shuttle astronauts, I applied, as did tens of thousands of people. And it took me 3 applications before I was selected.
How did you nail the third?
I have no idea. If I'd known that, I would have nailed the first.
Maybe they were like, oh, Marsha's tried again. We've got to give her a go eventually.
Here she comes again,
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Drawing Room, and I'm joined tonight by the former astronaut Marsha Ivins. She's the space consultant on a new IMAX documentary called A Beautiful Planet. So I have to ask the gender question because it's hard not to when you're one of so few. There are very few women who become astronauts. How does a young girl even embark on that, given all of your role models are men?
Well, I didn't really have any role models, men or women. I had my role model was the space program. You know, to be part of that was the goal. And I just decided to not let it bother me. I figured one day women are going to be in the space program. It's just inevitable in my mind. And by the time I'm old enough to be there, they will have sorted it out probably. And if not, I'll worry about it then. Of the 550 total people who have been astronauts worldwide, probably 57, 58 are women. So about 10%. And we're seeing a higher percentage of women being selected now as astronauts. And I think really because more women are studying science and technical fields than they did in the early days.
What were your jobs when you were on the space shuttles?
The space shuttle flights all have a very specific mission, whether it is to repair the Hubble telescope or put a satellite in orbit or build a part of the International Space Station. So depending on what the mission was, depended on my job. I was not one of the pilots, so I never sat in the pilot or the commander's seat, but I was the flight engineer on 3 of my flights. And so I'm the one that would keep the pilot and commander sort of straight and on course and make sure that everybody was working the right procedure that they needed to work at the right time. I was the robotic arm operator on 3 of my flights. The last flight, I was the robotic arm operator that actually installed the laboratory module. So I personally put on one big piece of the space station, which is sort of my proudest moment. And then I was assigned to do different experiments.
Were there any hairy moments?
No, we didn't have any really, well, we had some hairy moments. I mean, when I would wash my hair, it, you know, got a little hairy. But as far as nail biters and scary things, there was really nothing that went so horribly wrong that it was one of those things movies are made of. There's never a flight where everything works perfectly, but your training is all about the things that go wrong, the little things, the annoyances, and their procedures and workarounds and techniques and incredible redundancy on the hardware and the technical parts of it. So if some part of it works, you can still get your task done by using another part. And so we had some of those things on every flight, but nothing worth writing home about.
So do you have to be fearless then?
No, I don't think you have to be fearless. I think you have to be respectful. Going to space is not a routine thing, and as has been demonstrated through the decades, it's not necessarily a sure thing, you know, and there have been really horrible and tragic accidents, and it's not a surprise, it's always a shock and a horror, but we all know in the back of our minds that that is a risk. We choose to take that risk because we think the reward is worth it.
What is it about the reward? What's the personal reward? I know what the broader reward is, but on a personal level, what's the reward?
I was proud to get the job done. I still have to sort of look back and think, really, I left the planet?
Yes.
Who says that? I left the planet.
Correct, which is how I feel about it.
And that's kind of, for me, the personal reward, to have been given the opportunity, not just once, but you know, more than once, to do this incredible thing that for me was a lifelong dream, that in itself is the whole reward. And because I have been so fortunate, I will never win a lottery. You know, I've used my luck already.
Yep, all your luck's out.
Yeah.
You spent over 1,000 hours in space. We learn in the film A Beautiful Planet about the effect time in space has on the human body. People gain inches and other US astronauts' eyes are being studied. Did you notice any physical effects?
Well, everybody gets a little taller when you take gravity out of the picture. If you think about the way your spinal cord in your spinal column is put together. It's a bunch of little bones, which is your vertebrae, and they're separated by discs. And that allows you to be springy. You know, you can stand up straight or you can slouch and things like that. When you take, and you're used to being in compression because gravity sort of holds you down nicely compressed. When you take gravity away, you can and do get longer based on your anatomy. So I am not a tall person. You know, I grew maybe an inch, something like that. And then when you come back to gravity, you get short again.
Oh.
You know, you recompress again. So that goes away. And I thought, oh, bummer. You know, sometimes it's really helpful
too.
To be taller. Yeah. So you don't get to keep that. There are vision changes. Many people have vision changes because without gravity, the shape of your eyeball changes. And that changes the way you refract light. And for shuttle flights, for short duration flights, it all went back the way it was. As we started flying people longer in space, 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, there have been a number of people who have come back whose vision didn't correct. So now NASA is studying that to try to understand why. It's not that you're blind. It's just that you need slightly stronger glasses, perhaps, when you come back. In the early days of flying long duration in space, they found that people were losing bone mass from being without gravity. And a significant percent, 17% of your bone mass. And the bigger the bone, the more you would lose. Now on board the space station, the crews exercise 2.5 hours every day with aerobic and resistive exercise. And now they are not measuring any significant bone loss when they come back. So we're learning as we go.
In terms of the space program, what has the end of the U.S. space shuttle program in 2011 meant for American space travel?
Well, the significant thing is that it means that since the shuttle retired in 2011, we have not in America been able to send American astronauts to space on American spacecraft. We have been sending our American astronauts to space on the Russian Soyuz. That's the first time in the history of the U.S. space program that we have not had a capability to send American astronauts to space in American spacecraft. We had a plan that would have replaced the shuttle with an American-made spacecraft, and sadly, the space program is subject to the whim of whatever the presidential party is, and a new president canceled it.
Is there frustration with that among the astronaut community?
I think there was a lot of frustration amongst that. The shuttle was an amazing piece of technology, an amazing vehicle, but it had its limitations. You couldn't take the shuttle beyond the 400-kilometer Earth orbit. I mean, you just couldn't. It wasn't like the space station powered by solar arrays. It had a consumable propellant in it that generated electricity, and when you were out of that and you're out of electricity, you have to come home. So we could never have taken it to the moon. We could never have taken it beyond Earth orbit. It needed to be replaced with something. So the plan had been to use the shuttle to finish the construction of the space station, for which it was perfect. It had a very large cargo bay, and each part of the space station was carried on a shuttle flight one at a time, 37 flights, to build that space station. Retire it and then use the money that you were using to support operations of the space shuttle to build a new program. So yeah, I think people have been very frustrated.
And what do you think the role for space exploration is into the future? I mean, what's the next frontier?
Well, since we're using the same technology that we've been using for the past 50 years, what is available in the exploration field is what we can reach. What we can reach is the moon or Mars. We can't really go much beyond that. If you look at the moons of Saturn, many of which would be fascinating, many of which might have liquid water and would be fascinating to study, and we just can't get there with people today. So I think the next step is to redevelop the capability to go to the moon. That's a practice area. It's like climbing a big mountain, climbing a small mountain before you climb the big mountain and sort of practicing. And the moon's our backyard. It takes 3 days to get to the moon. So let's practice there. And then Mars. And I think Mars is a very viable next option. And I think, personally, it's more interesting to people than an asteroid or some point in space where there's nothing there, particularly when movies like The Martian come out. And then, you know, it looks really fascinating to do that. But until there's new technology, we don't go much farther than that.
Marsha, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's former astronaut Marsha Ivins. She's the space consultant on a new IMAX documentary film called A Beautiful Planet that you can obviously see at IMAX. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Patricia Karvelas.